Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
Welcome to this episode of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling with Leighton Kling working behind the scenes. Coming up on today's episode, we'll look ahead to Prime Day, also a pharmacy purchase or a pharmacy chain purchase in the Pacific Northwest. In our news segment, we'll talk about Dollar General's new concept that they announced this past week. And our interview guest is Ron Thurston. He's the author of Retail Pride. Retail Pride, a book coming out October 13th. So here just in a few days by the time you hear this podcast launch, he's going to talk about how important personal interaction is in terms of driving the retail landscape. Also, why it is important for retail employees to take pride in their work and pride in their industry. Again, a drum we've been beating for years, and we are so excited to have him on the show. He's a high energy person, and I know if I were in a retail setting, certainly I would enjoy working alongside Ron or under Ron. So great interview coming up. We ask that you stick around for that. A reminder, you can like us or rate us however you access us, whether that be on Spotify, Apple Podcasts. We're on Amazon now as well. You can also check us out on social media at Retail Podcast, where we just uploaded some pictures from our archive, a trip to rural Oklahoma, as it were, last year, and some grocery stores there. Now, as we talked about in our news portion, we'll be discussing Dollar General, and the big headlines this week is that they were launching a concept geared towards higher income, or some even said wealthy customers. Now, this isn't exactly the case, and upon further inspection, we would argue that wealthy customers aren't exactly their target with this store model. We saw headlines saying otherwise, certainly on the Wall Street Journal or CNN, but it looks like their target with this store model, middle class female consumers. And we'll talk about their merchandise mix a little bit later on, but the news with this new store format, keeping in mind Dollar General really only has one store format right now, it caught many in the retail industry slightly off guard, as they've talked about similar style formats within their existing stores, kind of store within a store initiatives, if you will, on earnings calls. They haven't referenced something that's freestanding, and for good reason. You don't want competitors to get a leg up on you. But let's talk about this concept. It's called Pop Shelf, and that's stylized as all lowercase. So when you see it in the podcast description, for example, for this week, all lowercase, the store features 95% of items priced at $5 or less. The concept promises to have on-trend and seasonal home decor, HBA items, home cleaning supplies, party goods, and items for entertaining. In the company's words, they want the shopping experience to be, and I quote, fun, affordable, and stress-free. But when you take a step back and look at it, this is a lot closer to a Five Below concept that isn't completely focused on tweens and teens. This is like a Five Below that is focused more on, as we mentioned, those middle-class households, maybe some of those lower-to-middle-class households. And, you know, while Five Below might generally have customers from the middle or upper-middle class, I don't think anyone is arguing that they are targeting children of wealthy consumers, especially given their price points. Granted, we on the podcast might have a different idea of wealth than some, but the reality of it is most of Five Below's customers are going to be middle to upper middle class. In all likelihood, most of Pop Shelf's customers are going to be firmly middle class. Now, the two stores that they're launching to begin with are located in Dollar General's Tennessee wheelhouse. Namely, their first two locations are in the general Nashville area. Leighton mentioned on the show earlier this year, Nashville, a market that's generally seeing higher rates of retail real estate occupancy than others throughout the country. And the suggestion that Leighton made was essentially that the Nashville market appeared to be healthy as far as retail sales were concerned. He noted high levels of traffic at non-essential retailers, even as the pandemic was beginning to set in. He visited the area in mid-March, and specifically for Dollar General, the first Pop Shelf stores will be in suburb Hendersonville and then Clarksville, which is about 40 miles north-northwest, if you will, of Nashville near the Kentucky border. Now, Todd Vasos, the CEO of Dollar General, said in the prepared release that came out this week that the store concept, they hope, will provide more runway for future growth as a company, not just within this store concept. And you look at the store chain in Dollar General, they're adding 1,000 locations per year, and you think, what do you mean? You don't already have runway for growth. But you have to think at some point that that growth for the mainline Dollar General concept, that's going to begin to slow as rural and urban markets, particularly rural markets, become saturated with the smaller format general merchandises, whether that's Dollar General or Family Dollar. As such, this for Dollar General gives them a concept that can work in higher density shopping centers rather than as standalone stores. Oftentimes in urban areas, Dollar General tries to find pockets where they're maybe underserved a bit. So you're looking at things like food deserts and the like, where there's not a lot of retail. In rural areas, it's fairly easy for Dollar General because they simply find something without general merchandise retail and set up shop there. And you're looking in markets of 1,000 people or more, and in some cases, even slightly less than that. But in this circumstance, Dollar General, rather than building from the ground up like they typically do with their new stores, they're willing to take advantage of vacant retail real estate. And let's take the location in Clarksville, for example. That's opening where a recently vacated Pier 1 once was. So you think about the markets that typically have a Pier 1. You think about the neighborhoods that typically have a Pier 1. You're talking about huge retail centers, usually out parcels to malls and the like. And in fact, this location is an out parcel to a mall. Now, those who are aware, again, of Dollar General building out locations, making additions to their portfolio, adding these 1,000 stores a year, their new stores are almost 100% built to suit and almost 100% freestanding. That doesn't mean that they don't have stores still in shopping centers. And we've heard from some real estate brokers that Dollar General has actually been eager to move out of shopping centers to freestanding locations, but the extent to which they're actually doing this is up for debate. They're re-signing a lot of leases, they're extending a lot of leases in urban shopping centers, and a lot of their urban locations are still in these, what you would call a C-class or even some D-class shopping centers where they're not the only tenant. It's not a freestanding store, but their new stores are almost always freestanding. With PopShelf, at least so far, they're targeting B to B plus shopping centers. And again, you talk about that former Pier 1 in Clarksville, that's an outparcel to the Governor Square Mall, which is, by the way, run by Warner Management. They have a very high occupancy rate. A lot of anchors are still there. They haven't lost a lot of anchors, and they have a lot of the supporting shops still in place. And you look at the high traffic area of Clarksville, when you look at the data, it's a very high traffic location. And that compares to most Dollar General stores, which they're looking more for just having residential areas around that Dollar General so that they can serve those families in those markets. So again, a different overall concept. Clarksville Now, the website, clarksvillenow.com, reports that lighting and storage for that store, those were actually installed this week, and the stores are slated to be open by October 29th, at least for Clarksville they are. So Clarksville, Hendersonville, those locations will open later this month. Dollar General as a whole expects 30 locations in various markets by the end of fiscal 2021. So expansion not really going to be at the same rate as it's been with Dollar General. But what we've seen with Dollar General before is a limited trial to a limited number of stores, and then they tend to explode concepts. They've done this already with some of their curbside facets, where they trialed it in a limited number of stores, and then suddenly you look and it's in a third of their store portfolio. So this is not uncommon, and not an uncommon approach for Dollar General to kind of trial it, looking for 2 to 3 dozen locations, and then you might see it really take off in the next few years after the end of fiscal 2021. Now, going back to that wealthy shoppers notion, I think overall where Wall Street Journal and CNN get the wealthy shoppers notion is the fact that the stores are geared towards women from households making $50,000 to $125,000 per household. And Dollar General is pretty transparent about their target market. This is clearly middle class, though. When you look at it, you're not talking about wealthy consumers. You're talking about families that are comfortable in some cases, but again, a household making $50,000 in certain parts of the country isn't necessarily comfortable, depending on also how many children you have. And I think this fact, when you look at their target market, that's aligned at least somewhat with Dollar General's current customer base. And in fact, that's why Dollar General was able to test some of the facets that are going to be in the pop shelf stores in their Dollar General stores, is the fact that there is more to the middle of that Venn diagram than meets the eye. And the public impression is that Dollar General is a dollar store, and they're really a small format convenience general merchandise retailer. I think that's where the major misunderstanding hits. Their prices aren't necessarily that much lower than a Target or a Walmart, but their presence in rural communities means that a good portion of their customers are firmly middle class to begin with, because those middle class people in smaller communities, they don't have another game in town. Also, Dollar General sets up shop for those that are unfamiliar in the Midwest. You see a lot of resort areas or places where people might have summer homes near lakes and the like. A lot of Dollar General stores there too, and those people aren't exactly hurting for money. So I think people misunderstand the target market of Dollar General's. Does it skew lower income in urban areas? Yeah, a little bit. But in rural areas, they're really supporting all income groups. And I think that's important to keep in mind when you look at the pop shelf concept. Now, where the goals of Dollar General and pop shelf diverge is really in concept and merchandising more than anything. And of course, you're going to have a more limited product selection. You're not going to have as many consumables in pop shelf, but they want pop shelf to have less of a cluttered feel, cluttered being my word. And I'm sure that's something Dollar General would never use to describe their current stores. They want a bit of a boutique look. Store sections clearly marked based on category of merchandise. The stores, from the artist renderings and what we've heard, will have a bit of a more open feel than the many tall shelves that are currently in most Dollar General locations that segment the store into pieces from the time you walk in. In fact, it can be a little bit of an intimidating environment, and part of that is because they're trying to stuff so much merchandise and such a variety of merchandise in under 10,000 square feet in most cases. Now, for pop shelf, the stores are going to be around 9,000 square feet, which is right around the same size as new Dollar General stores that are built to suit. The pop shelf concept, as I mentioned before, that was born out of Dollar General's learnings from their non-consumables initiative, or NCI. This is what we mentioned when we say that they've alluded to this type of merchandise mix only on a section in store kind of level on prior earnings calls. On their previous earnings call, they talked about 4,300 of their Dollar General stores having adopted an increased SKU offering in NCI as a result of their NCI initiative. And again, that's something we talked about on this very podcast at the end of August. And stores with that increased SKU offering comped out 8% higher in their most recent quarter than those who didn't have the NCI build out. As a result, they noted that they expect about 5,400 overall Dollar General stores out of their over 16,000 locations in 46 states to have these expanded NCI SKUs by the end of the fiscal year. But again, they said all of this without saying anything about an entirely different concept altogether. And Emily Taylor, their executive vice president and chief merchandising officer, said this last week when they announced the pop shelf concept that their learnings in their NCI initiative within the Dollar General mainline stores directly allowed them to develop this idea as a result of their research and refresh of some of their private label products. And there will be crossover merchandise from Dollar General. So you look, they recently rebranded a number of these private label products that are in this NCI segment for them, for their mainline Dollar General stores. They're able to use that merchandise in the pop shelf stores because they feel like those refreshes have been so well regarded among their customer base. Again, more proof that there's more to the middle of the Venn diagram than a lot of media outlets suggest, and that's at least how Dollar General is viewing it. Now, I think the whole rebrand and refresh of their private label brands is important because the long-term success of this pop shelf brand is likely going to hinge on how customers view pop shelf. If they view pop shelf as an expansion of Dollar General, may not go over so well. Even though we noted there's likely to be some of that crossover in their traffic as a whole and in terms of their target markets, but due to the locations of pop shelf, we're not talking about a location of convenience like it is for many Dollar Generals. Customers will expect something of a higher class feel to the retailer, even if the price point isn't at that particular class. If PopShelf can develop their own presence, it might serve as a competitor to the likes of Home Goods and even other off-pricers, as we've seen prices on decor in that space go up slightly over the past 2 years in those type of locations and in these type of retail centers. And this is as a result of high demand and price optimization strategies for the off-pricers. We've talked several times over the last 3 to 4 years about the momentum towards off-price. But what else have we talked about? Price optimization strategies. Those companies want to put a higher price on their things the first time they attempt to sell them without having to clearance them off, because they know people are coming through the doors. And so you're seeing prices creep up, especially in some of these NCI areas that Dollar General is looking to capitalize on with PopShelf. As a result, they might be in a great position to maybe capitalize on this. And because Dollar General isn't exactly known for these categories, although I would argue maybe they should be because they've seen so much momentum there and people are obviously buying the products, the success of PopShelf long-term is likely going to hinge on a direct separation of brand, if at all possible. And we can see through the logo, through the design, through the presentation, and through the location that Dollar General is clearly aiming for this. These stores look nothing like Dollar General stores. They're completely different. And I think in terms of neighborhood, in terms of the location, in terms of the everything about these stores, even the store layouts, they are trying to differentiate PopShelf from Dollar General. You're not going to see anything that says PopShelf by Dollar General. They are looking for a clear separation. And if they can retain that, I think this concept is a brilliant one. And it's something that a lot of people are looking for, especially when it comes to seasonal products. And again, going back to Dollar General's success in NCI, where they had the most success in seasonals. This is something where Dollar General has the background knowledge, they've got the research, they've got the recent rebrand. Everything should add up to a success. But one thing we haven't quite talked about, because of those locations that they're setting up in, higher rent rates, and also there will be a few more staff members. They're looking at about 15 staff members per store. Some Dollar General locations run with as few as 10. So few extra costs for them, but I think overall Dollar General is going to find this worth it if they can make sure everything is divided up in terms of brand. So that's our news segment for the day. Once again, coming up in our interview segment after this break, Ron Thurston. He's the author of Retail Pride. It's a great book. It's coming out this week. I had a chance to read it early to prep for the interview. It is a great book. It's inspiring, and he'll be joining us on the other side of this. No matter through which lens you look at retail, it's a vital part of our economy here in the United States. And while it's easy to become distracted with the news stories, especially of late regarding this push towards e-commerce, it's just as easy to forget that brick and mortar still very much drives the retail landscape. It's the core of the retail landscape. And during the early days of the pandemic, the country found out just how impactful retail employees are as they were bestowed the essential worker status. Yet those of us in the retail world knew just how essential retail employees have been all along. Our guest today is Ron Thurston. He's the author of the upcoming book, Retail Pride, which will be out October 13th. The book is not only a guide for retail employees seeking to maybe grow their career, but I think at least it's an affirmation of sorts for those retail employees who begin to speak in maybe a mumble whenever they're asked what they do for a living. It's all in the title, Retail Pride. And Ron, thank you for joining the podcast today.
Thank you, Trent. Excited to be here.
First, obviously, you wouldn't be writing a book about retail careers if you didn't have one yourself. You've got over 2 decades of retail experience, and I was wondering if you could maybe discuss a little bit about how you began working in retail and kind of your own career path, which you kind of term in the book as an accidental career.
Thank you so much. So yes, it was accidental in the commitment I made to it, I would say, which is also part of the conversation of moving it from accidental to intentional. But my career really began as a young man studying both fashion design and retail administration at FITM on the West Coast. And I kind of did have this dream of being a fashion designer and did that for several years, but really very accidentally became an assistant manager at Gap Kids early 90s and immediately fell in love with it and immediately understood the passion and the drive and the energy and the commitment that it takes to run great retail. And I made that commitment then of like, this seems like something I could do really well. I have a background in design. I understand fabric and kind of the idea of how construction is done. And kids just seemed so interesting and energetic and wanted to build a career from there. And Gap at the time provided that for me. So I had to move through store manager roles, district manager roles, head of visual merchandising, and had a really great run, and then chose some exceptional brands who were in really important points in their career. So brands like West Elm in kind of its early days, I opened many stores for West Elm. I ran Tory Burch out of the West Coast and moved here to New York and helped launch the D2C brand Bonobos and built the infrastructure for their store fleet. And then most recently ran the Americas for Saint Laurent, my first European luxury retail experience. And today I'm the vice president of stores for Intermix, which is also part of Gap. So I've come back to the Gap family today to run their smallest, but I would say one of the most interesting divisions in the company.
So it really is kind of a who's who. Obviously, we're big fans of especially West Elm, for example, on the podcast. Now, through this retail career that you've had, usually the idea for a book doesn't just appear out of nowhere all at once and you're like, oh, okay, in 5 minutes, I've got this written in my head. What was your thought process behind the book concept as you began to kind of piece together the mission of the book?
I've spent, as you've said, a couple of decades, and much of that has been in interviews. Much of it has been hiring, store visits, just sitting, listening, observing. And the journey toward the book was really my continued observation that people in the industry don't always have the pride that they deserve, don't always get that recognition, don't always have the voice of how incredible it is to have a career in retail. And so I actually started a blog several years ago and just tested ideas of how do you feel about working in the industry? Let me write about the industry, write about the people and culture, and just tested some things and learned a ton. And then last year decided to actually make the commitment to get this finished. I would say I was nearly completely done writing the book in March and then went back and added some points around COVID. But the true core of what this is about is really, it's not COVID related and it's not about the future of the industry. This is to celebrate the millions of people that work in it and to recognize it as an incredible career path.
You mention it in the book that people with retail careers or working in retail jobs a lot of times come from very different aspects of, you know, personal life. They're in retail for different reasons. And a lot of times people start their retail careers when young or perhaps as a job between jobs, so to speak. What encourages people to stay in the retail field and develop their careers?
I actually think one of the most important things you can do is choose the right brand to work for, the right culture, and the right people. And there's so many different versions of retail, whether it's kind of entry price point through grocery, through pharmacy, through apparel, contemporary brands, luxury brands, home furnishings. There's a variety of things. So I actually think doing your homework in advance and saying, well, what am I most passionate about? What are my best skills? And let's choose a brand that aligns really well with what I know I can do and what I can learn. And from there, I think it's spending a lot of time learning who the leadership team is. Why do you want to work there? What value can you add? And what can they add to you? I speak in the book, you know, that culture is not a top-down idea. Culture should really be about bottoms up, and that we all influence culture, whether it's in your store, on your team, in your company. And so I think it's doing your homework, which is the advice I often give candidates. Choose the brand that's right for you, not just because they have an open role. And that's, I think, part of the retail success story for many people was being in the right brand at the right time with the right people around you, with a really thriving culture. And then it's so engaging and so interesting. You don't want to leave. You get completely enthralled by the idea of how to grow your career in retail. And those brands exist all over the country, all over the world. And more than ever today, it's about choosing those that will thrive in the future and help you build your career.
Now, I don't want to get too far off the beaten path here, but we're always interested in everyone's own retail journey, so to speak. And you mentioned it's about the right brand, right place, right time. And in the opening, you mentioned that the energy surrounding Gap Kids was captivating for you. How different might your retailer career have been had it been not Gap Kids, had it been maybe something you weren't as interested in?
It's such a great question because I've thought about it. And then I did consider it accidental for so long. And then once I got further in and just say 2-3 years in, I was a district manager at that point. I said, I'm going to make this the best experience for myself and for my team. And even then, there were constant changes in brands and consolidations. We merged adult and kids, and a lot of things happened over the decade I was there. But I made it my own experience and not just the company. So the company was very solid and provided those tools for me, but I also created it for myself. And I think that that's an opportunity for culture and training of what do I need? How can I make this great? And if none of that is working, you may be working for the wrong company, but those opportunities to build greatness around you and change the trajectory are, I think, also such an important and interesting part of this industry because it's ripe for evolution.
So we've talked a little bit about the process of starting that retail career, about the process of researching the perfect retailer, the perfect time, place, and so forth. What are some key facets to what makes for a successful retail career when all is said and done? And what are some of the core skills that retail careers really allow individuals to develop?
Sure. So I write in the book kind of the three pillars of expertise that I'd like to call it, that regardless of your role, so stock, sales, key holders, store manager, assistant manager, district manager, whatever your role is, or even in a corporate function, there are three pillars for me that really set up excellence. So the first one's empathy. The second one is curiosity. And the third is focus. And when I think about empathy, that applies in so many different parts of our lives, but particularly in retail. The empathy to understand the customer experience, to understand your team experience, to be curious about what's happening, curiosity in sales, curiosity in the world around you and how you can make it better, and curiosity about your company. And I say focus very intentionally because focus in our world is often hard to achieve. If you think about the busiest days in retail, and I would reference my years that I had at Apple, which were early iPhone years. You know, when you think about when we used to wait in line for a week to buy a phone, and a level of traffic and intensity and questions, and to be honest, just the unknown, my ability to focus at that time as a store manager said, I'm going to create an environment that is the best day for my team, the best day for the customer. We're going to sell a whole lot of phones today, but I'm going to be focused in how I do it. I'm empathetic to the line, and I'm going to bring you snacks. I'm curious about why you want to buy this crazy new thing called an iPhone, and I'm focused on what I want to accomplish today. And so I try to apply those filters, and I would encourage really everyone that can do the same thing in our business. I really believe, regardless of role, that can take you very far.
So you mentioned empathy, and I want to kind of expand on that because you make an interesting point. I believe it's early on in the book that some people get exhausted with e-commerce at certain points, and people circle back to brick and mortar as a refuge because they're able to interact with store associates. The retail employee, that empathy is a big reason for that. I was wondering if you could maybe discuss that concept a bit, because I know from our position, at least, it certainly seems like the way in which e-commerce is portrayed is that it's responsible for the vast majority of the retail sales in the U.S., but that's just not the case. And it's still very much about brick and mortar and very much about that person-to-person interaction.
It's so true. And I love to kind of share the phrase that retail will really help us reconnect the world because it brings us together. The idea of having your favorite stores, your favorite local businesses, even your favorite restaurants, it helps us reconnect our world today that has been through such a traumatic last 6 months. But exactly to your point, the news could portray this, that e-commerce and Amazon have taken over all of this business, but the facts actually don't dictate that. The facts are, yes, e-commerce has grown exponentially this year, 30, 40% comps potentially, but we'll finish the year, you know, at about 15% of total commerce done, which leaves 85% on the brick and mortar side. And estimated kind of a single point addition to that every year for the next several years still puts it at kind of 82% brick and mortar, 18% e-commerce. And I will take 82% any day. And I'll say, we're going to be the best at this 82% of the economy in every aspect that we do, and bring people along that are ready for that career, are ready to shine in this industry, and to not be afraid of the other side of our business in e-commerce. Celebrate it, recognize it, use it to your advantage, but know that people coming in want to see you. They want to experience your brand. You use your brand as a marketing tool. You want to create an environment that is an incredible place to work and an incredible place to shop. And if nothing is sold in that four walls, but the customer has had an experience with you and your team, then all the business happens on e-commerce, which is exactly what we built at Bonobos. Nothing was ever sold in the store. We placed orders on the website for delivery at home. But the experience that I really wanted to help them achieve was this high touch, fitting, styling experience. But then you go home and place an order, and that is perfectly fine. And it's a very successful business model for them.
So we've talked a little bit about, obviously, the human-to-human, person-to-person interaction, but it's not just from store associate or employee to customer. Another thing you hit on in the book is this unique nature of retail associates or those with careers in retail to share knowledge and be enthusiastic about really passing on what they've learned, passing on their expertise. And honestly, it's one of the reasons why we never run out of guests for the podcast. So in that respect, it's obviously a positive. But after your discussions with retail leaders for the book and your own retail experience, why do you believe this is? Why do you believe that there's so much of this free flow of information from one level to the next?
I think inherently we recognize the fact that there's not one specific college degree that makes you a great retail leader. You may be an expert in human resources. You may have strong visual merchandising skills. You may be great in ops, and maybe you have a finance degree. All of that is great, but nothing will train you in advance for a successful retail career. You have to do the work, and you have to surround yourself, as I mentioned earlier, with people who will help you learn how to do it. And I think that there's a generosity of spirit of people who work in retail that we want to bring people along. We want to create this family kind of idea, and we want to teach you, and we want to support you. And we're, I think, generous about how to take people to the next part of their career, whatever that career might look like for you. I think there's something really inherently interesting about the attitude that most retail leaders have around sharing their knowledge and bringing people forward. And I think it's actually very special.
Now, we know we have a lot of listeners out there who are fairly advanced in their retail careers, but we also have a decent number who are either just starting their retail career, thinking about starting their retail career. Other than the right place, right time, making sure that you're at a retailer that aligns with your personal values, what are some things that people that are early in their retail careers can do or should be doing to kind of figure out where they want to fit in the future in the retail landscape?
I would certainly encourage you to, from a product side, where do you gravitate as a consumer? You know, Sephora is such a great example. While I don't have personal experience with the brand, you know, they are one of the most successful retailers out there. And the people that I do know that work for the brand and have a passion for skincare and makeup absolutely love working at Sephora. And the idea, if you love fashion and you love, you know, trend and presentation, a brand like I work for today with Intermix is very much on the forefront of trend and fashion and what's happening in the seasons. And maybe you are completely obsessed with home decoration. So I would assess what you love to do and why you love to do it. I would figure out what really motivates you and inspires you, and how do you want to be led? What do you want to do? And that it's not just a temporary job, that you really are recognizing this as intentional, but know coming into the conversation or into your research a little bit about why you will be successful going into this, and even start the conversation or the interview with, this is the homework I've done. This is what I know I'm really good at. This is what I can contribute to your organization. Here's how I can influence culture, and come into it strong and proud and believe that you can make a difference. And that, for me, which also highly motivates me in this conversation and in the book, is really just own it. Don't say, oh yeah, like this is temporary. Like I'm really thinking about doing something else long-term. That's not gonna get you the career in this industry that you want. Own it and believe in it and believe in yourself.
One more book-related question, or book content-related question at least. Something that caught me by a bit of surprise as I began to dive into the manuscript, all of the great insights from all kinds of retail leaders, a vast diversity of retail leaders reflected in the book. What was it like for you in the process of writing this book to talk about retail careers specifically with so many people that have so many decades of experience?
It's so fun because there are people in the book who I've been peers with, friends with, have worked for me. And the joy of listening to them kind of quote their favorite parts of retail and leadership and why they love this business and how they've created connections and what they love about serving others, even just collecting that. And this, what's in the book is probably a tenth of what I have on file. I had so much information from people who wanted to talk about their love of this industry. And I wanted to really say, this is not just my story, it's our story as an industry. We're highly collaborative. And the idea that everyone has contributed to the pride of the industry was really important. I think it's actually so much fun to be able to have friends and colleagues quoted in the book. They're very happy about it, and I'm really happy to be able to do it. And I actually think there's a whole another book coming that could even take that further, that recognizes all the different levels and all the different kinds of opportunities that we have, and hear it from people who have done the work.
I was going to say, if you only use 10% of your material, that was going to be my next question, is there's a sequel coming out?
But there definitely could be.
Well, the book Retail Pride comes out October 13th. It's just a couple of days after this podcast launches. If people are super stoked after this conversation, if they want to check it out, how can they access the book? How can they buy the book?
Yeah, so the book will be available on Amazon on October 13th, hardcover, paperback, and ebook. I also have a website, retailpride.com. If you sign up, I'm probably going to do some blogging after this as follow-ups, some conversations, maybe some live webinars where we can talk about, have live book clubs. The piece I would add, you know, as you kind of look at hardcover versus soft, the cover of the book is really a kaleidoscope, and it's an art piece. And the intent is that retail is art. And I wanted to be able to celebrate retail as an art form, not just in words. So the cover on the hardback, actually the back of it has no text. And that's intentional because it should look like art. And I wanted to say, I am so proud to work in retail, and I really think of it in the world of an art celebration and the colors and all the different people that work together. And so you'll see that on the hardcover. The paperback has bio and pictures, but it's also like still great.
That's fantastic. I honestly, as someone who has read the book now, of course, highly recommend it for anyone that's listening out there. Ron Thurston, once again, author of Retail Pride. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Once again, we thank Ron for joining us. And as he mentioned, the book will be available on the 13th of October, basically wherever you can find books, but of course, available on the ubiquitous Amazon as well. You can also check out his website, retailpride.com, easy enough to remember. And as he mentioned, he might be starting a blog up there, but he certainly got some announcements and other news that's going on there. So, Ron, an excellent retail resource, and looking forward to, if there is certainly a second version, looking forward to that. Now, in our looking ahead segment, I think we're looking ahead to, just as everyone else is, Prime Day, which is coming up later this week, the 17th through the 19th, so Prime Days, if you will. And the reason we'll be looking ahead to this is it's not just because of Amazon sales and Prime Day sales, but as we've talked to others on the show in the past, most notably Danny Cushion of Cardlytics, the fact that Prime Day has always had this effect of boosting sales of other retailers because other retailers are also running deals, they're running sales during Prime Day, especially as it pertains to the e-commerce space. If this is something that other retailers plan to do, and from all accounts, it looks like most other retailers are indeed planning to do this again this year, does this push retail holiday sales up a little bit? And more importantly, we hear from all kinds of economists out there that holiday spending this year might be pretty volatile and it might be affected by a number of factors. We've seen Jack Kleinhens from NRF come out and say this. We saw Deloitte come out and say this when they released their holiday projections. You've got a presidential election, you've got COVID going on, of course, you've got the pandemic, and developments in either one of those could drastically affect the way in which spending occurs surrounding the holiday season. So is this the opportunity, is this the main opportunity, in fact, a couple of weeks before the election, to get those holiday sales from customers, to boost those holiday sales? And if so, are we going to be looking at October same-store sales being up double digits for a lot of retailers over last year, and then November and December same-store sales sagging maybe more than expected? So a lot to come out of Prime Day here, but again, this is a big opportunity for retailers to lock in those sales before what could be a very volatile last 2 months of the year. Now, maybe a bigger looking ahead story, at least from my perspective. Now, Prime Day is going to be bigger in the macro, but to me, this is bigger just in terms of sentiment, because we got word this week that Bartell Drugs, which has been in the Pacific Northwest for many years, this is their 130th year of operation. If you're not familiar with the Seattle area, and again, that's a place where Leighton and I have spent a significant amount of time. We spent time there as children as well. That is being sold to Rite Aid, and the purported sale price is $95 million. Now, Rite Aid does have a few stores in the Seattle region, which is around where most of the Bartell Drugs stores are. 67 stores to be purchased by Rite Aid, none of them planning to close just yet. And I think there's a couple of things that really stand out. One is that there's not a whole lot of locally run drugstore chains left. You look at all of the chains that have been bought out over the last 10 to 15 to 20 years. Eckerd is no longer there. Revco is no longer there. Drug Warehouse, Mays, Long's, you could go on and on. There's a lot of these drugstores that have been bought up by what you would call the big three, although some term it the big two, with just CVS and Walgreens and Rite Aid lacking pretty far behind. Rite Aid still has 2,400 stores, and this is just a modest increase to their store portfolio. But one of the things is Bartell's is seen as maybe a bit of an upper crust pharmacy chain, if you will. It's got a massive following in the Pacific Northwest, particularly in and around Seattle, and that's a following that Rite Aid doesn't necessarily have. The sale price looks pretty low, $95 million for 67 stores, and this tells you that perhaps the family-operated drugstore chain, and it was still in the family up until the sale goes through for Rite Aid, it's been in the family for generation after generation, but it tells you that they might have been having some financial trouble of late, because that is a fairly low sale price for 67 stores. Now, one of the benefits for the deal, and this is something that George D. Bartell talked about, and he's the chairman of the firm, is that the deal will enable the Bartell Drugs label to go on into the future. So that's going to be key. Also, it's going to maintain and retain a lot of the corporate employees for Bartell Drugs. Now, again, they haven't announced any store closures. It seems like most of the stores are going to stay open, but you're looking at a chain that may be struggling financially. We don't really know because, again, they're privately held. What we can say is that over the last 15 years, this chain has gone through a number of sale leasebacks with the real estate. And honestly, some of this real estate hugely valuable in the Seattle area, but they've been doing 15-year sale leasebacks gradually with some of their locations. We don't know, again, private chain, how many of those locations are still owned by the company. If some are still owned by the company, that certainly should have added a little bit of value to the sale price. But again, you're looking at long-term leases for these drugstores, often on hard corners or kind of the micro downtown areas where you have Seattle suburbs that might have their own downtowns. You see Bartell Drugs there quite a bit. So the reason I'm looking ahead to this is, what are Rite Aid's plans with Bartell Drugs? Again, we know they're going to keep the label at least for now, but how long does that last, and how long is the agreement for that to last? Does Rite Aid get any real estate out of it? Do you start to see those properties show up on the retail real estate market as Rite Aid tries to gain some benefit from the sale? And then also, is this an indicator of other local drugstore chains that might be struggling? We saw just a few years ago Fred's sell off their pharmacy division, and they were heartily struggling quarter after quarter in terms of sales. I think this is maybe somewhat of an indicator of the fact that you're seeing a lot of these local chains, the ones that still exist, and there are so few of them at this point compared to how many there were 20 years ago, in this financial trouble because of a number of factors. Of course, Medicare reimbursement, insurance reimbursement, chief among them, but you're also looking at expanded competition, economies of scale from CVS and Walgreens. So a lot going on in this particular space. It's kind of sad to see the independence of Bartell Drugs whittle away, but at least this deal will keep the label alive. And for those that have ties to the Seattle area, that certainly is absolutely of importance there. So, interesting deal for Rite Aid to buy a 130-year-old chain that might be financially struggling, especially since Rite Aid has been in the business of kind of selling off their own stores of late. So, kind of an interesting deal, and we'll keep an eye on Rite Aid as they seek to maybe expand to once again compete with the likes of CVS and Walgreens, if only on a regional basis. That'll do it for this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. Once again, we thank Ron Thurston for joining us. Coming up, we'll talk next week to Peter Schara of Stratix. He's going to discuss everything moving curbside in retail. And we've talked about this before on the podcast, but the interesting thing, from Peter's perspective at least, is making the systems behind the scenes support this. So especially with point of sale, how do you move point of sale outside? How do you move it curbside? How do you implement those processes? He's going to talk about that, as well as some interesting things regarding implementing those for Apple or iPhone and Android purposes, because there is a little bit of difference in terms of implementation of the software. So I think it's an interesting interview. You'll find it fascinating next week. Well, once again, for Leighton Behind the Scenes, I'm Trent saying so long. We thank you for listening.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.